Monday. I just didn't know. Excellent. Oh, good. Marvelous. This clock doesn't work, and it looks too complicated, so we'll go with mine. I have 8:59. Is anybody? I'm a little fast. We'll wait a minute just so that we get the tape started. 9 o'clock. Tape room, we're ready to roll. My name is Ruth Hanusa, and this is the third session in my first week here. Today we're going to do Hosea chapter 5 and 6, and probably some of it 7. And I've entitled this, To Know is to Love. Do you remember that song? To know him is to love him. I didn't want to put him on the board because of, you know, trying to clean up our language, so it limps a little. But that's really, I think, the theme of what's going on in the central part of Hosea. Yahweh says, to know me is to love me. I want to, lest you think that chapter 4 has nothing worth bothering with, since I skipped it, I picked out just a couple of verses to highlight. We just can't do it all. It's too rich. So you've got it for, here it is, another time. In verse 1 of 4, the problem, hear the word of the Lord. The Lord has a controversy. He's going to bring a lawsuit with the inhabitants of the land. There is no faithfulness or kindness, no knowledge of God in the land. That's the problem as Hosea sees it. The fertility cults that we laid out yesterday are, in a sense, just the first layer, like when you do archaeological digs and you strip off layer by layer to get out what's underneath. Just the top layer of this stuff is their religious life. Another layer is that there's no knowledge of God in the land, and we'll get to that in chapter 6. But instead of knowledge of God, so this is opposite, there is swearing, lying, killing, stealing, and committing adultery. They break all bounds, and murder follows murder. Martin Luther says that the only two big sins are despair and unbelief. The puppy sins are things like murder, adultery, lying, raping, killing, you know. Those are the puppy sins. I'm going to let you think about that for a minute. Hosea is saying the same thing, I think. He was quoting Luther. Verse 6 here in chapter 4, again, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. No knowledge of God is the problem, okay? In verses 4 and 5 and 8, the people who are held responsible for this are the priests and prophets, who were charged with the responsibility of giving the people, of helping them, I don't even want to say learn, were responsible for the people having knowledge of God, and they fell down on their responsibility. In verse 12 and 13 in chapter 4, we get a little view of what this cult was like. By the way, someone afterwards told me that Ezekiel chapter 16 and 23, especially in the Jerusalem Bible, is quite vivid in its explication of what went on in the cult practices. I haven't read it all yet. I saw a few verses. It's vivid, let me tell you. So if you want to know more of what they actually did. In verse 12, my people inquire of a thing of wood. It was some sort of thing for foretelling the future. And their staff gives them oracles. Same idea. Verse 13, they sacrifice on the tops of mountains and make offerings upon the hills under oak, poplar, and terebinth. In the groves and on the hills is often a phrase that the prophets use. This is where they carried on the cult practices, the sexual practices, under trees and groves and on the top of hills. Okay. Yesterday we talked a little bit about women seeming to get a really bad shake in this situation, harlots and the wounded one is the husband and so forth. Well, in verse 14, men get their due too. I will not punish your daughters when they play the harlot, nor your brides when they commit adultery. For the men themselves go aside with harlots and sacrifice with cult prostitutes. And a people without understanding shall come to ruin. Everybody's involved. Okay, I think I'm going to pick up at verse 8 in chapter 5. 5 starts out with the priests again being called to accountability, that they have been a part of the problem. If you want to know what some of those names are, this glossary that I have in my little thing, bookstore sold out, but I have a couple copies. We'll give you the names. I don't want to take a lot of time telling what happened at each one. But in verse 8, we have a warning being sounded. Blow the horn in Gibeah, the trumpet in Ramah, sound the alarm in Bethaven. Those are towns that are north from Jerusalem. Gibeah, 3 miles, I think, Ramah, 5, and Bethaven, 11. So from the south, Judah is going to be invading Ephraim. There's a lot of political wrangling going on. So there was a threat coming from the inside group. Bethaven is, I think that's how it's pronounced, is Hosea's name for Bethel. Bethel was the house of God, Beth-El. Avon means nothing. He says it has become so corrupted it is now the house of nothing. So whenever you see that, he's referring to Beth-El at that point. Okay, and then in verse 10, he says, you know, this Judah, we kept harking back to Judah, the tribe of David, and it would be reunited. Judah gets its due here too. Judah is not without sin. The princes of Judah, verse 10, have become like those who removed the landmark. What do you think that is? You stake out a land, and this is the property line. Princes of Judah, move it to their favor. They're stealing. At verse 12, we get another interesting picture of Yahweh. Hosea has many, many pictures of God in here. I think we do well to think about them. They kind of can expand our view of the Trinitarian. Therefore, I am like a moth to Ephraim, Ephraim being wool cloth or something, and like dry rot to the house of Judah. What do you think of God being dry rot? Now, here in 13, we begin to get into a whole section that goes even into 7. I don't know how much time we'll have for that. Talking about the political situation. This is another layer of the sin going on. Heschel refers to it as political promiscuity in his theme with harlotry. He says, when Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah his wound, then Ephraim went to Assyria, he sent to the great king. But he is not able to cure you or heal your wound. In a century, I'll give you a bit of political situation now. The century before Hosea began writing, middle of the 8th century, middle of the 9th century, Assyria was on the rise. This great power was beginning to conquer all of the Mediterranean area. And there was a coalition of kings, one of whom was King Ahab. Remember wicked King Ahab with his wicked queen Jezebel, and they're just rotten to the core? These kings made a little coalition, and at this brilliant battle at Karkar, the Assyrians were defeated and were kept quiet for 100 years. And it was good old wicked King Ahab who was the brilliant general in this particular battle. Bible doesn't talk much about that. They don't care about his secular successes. He was wicked, and that's what they remind us of. But secular sources tell us that it was Ahab who was the brilliant general who kept the Assyrians at bay for 100 years. Then in about 745, which is about the time that Hosea begins writing, or the prophecies come to him, Tiglath-Pileser comes to the throne. I'm reading the Agatha Christie Jane Marple story where one of the Anglican priests names his cat Tiglath-Pileser. And he begins, he's a strong, capable leader, and he begins to systematically conquer all of the neighboring peoples. Well, the other main contender in the world at that time was Egypt. And you know, the Palestine and these little tiny states, I mean, Ephraim is tiny, Judah's tiny, Syria is tiny, they're all little dinky things. So they're kind of between these two wheels of these great powers, United States and Russia, and they kind of get squished sometimes. So what happens is that they keep listening to the news, and whoever seems to be in the ascendancy, they'll go and run and make a deal and back and forth. So there's a lot of shilly-shallying between becoming a vassal of Assyria and then trying to make a deal with Egypt. And that's what's going on here. Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah his wound. They realize that they are in a rather delicate situation. So they go to Assyria and sent to the great king, Tiglath-Pileser. But he is not able to cure you or heal your wound. There's a judgment on doing this kind of back and forth. Always, you know, trying to get your short-term political security. It's a judgment on that rather than trusting God. And so God says, I will be like a lion. Another picture of God to Ephraim. I will rend and go away. I will carry off, and none shall rescue. He will tear them to shreds like a lion does its prey and carry it off to the lair. By the way, if you want to read some of this, it's in 2 Kings 15 to 20 has the historical record, if you want to pick up on that some other point. Okay, so this is God saying in 15, this is the main part of what I want to get to. I will return again to my place, my lion's den, until they acknowledge their guilt and seek my face, and in their distress they seek me. In the Hebrew, there's a period, and there is nothing that corresponds to the saying and the quotation marks that follow. If you've got RSV, that's what it says. And it sounds as though God is favorably quoting this, wants the people to repent in this way. If you have Jerusalem, there's a period, and then they give a heading to chapter 6, which says, Israel short-lived and shallow repentance. That is more accurate according to the Hebrew. God says, I'm going to go off until they repent and come looking for me. I'm tired of, as someone said yesterday, wimpishly running around town looking for this harlot Israel. I'm just going to go off. I've had enough. Okay. So the people, this is a liturgical song. Come, let us return to the Lord, for he has torn that he may heal us. He has stricken and he will bind us up. After 2 days he will revive us. On the third day he will raise us up, that we may live before him. Let us know, let us press on to know the Lord. His going forth is sure as the dawn. He will come to us as the showers, as the spring rains that water the earth. We got cancer, but I think if we take 2 aspirin and drink a lot of fluids and get a couple days bed rest, it'll all be better. And God says in 4, what shall I do with you, O Ephraim? What shall I do with you, O Judah? Your love is like a morning cloud, like the dew that goes early away. I think that is strong enough evidence that verses 1 to 3 are the people's idea of cheap grace. It's God's idea to forgive. That's his job. What else does he have to do? Everything's in a mess. He obviously isn't worrying about the world. All he's got to do is forgive. Come on. Come on. Do your job. We're doing ours. He said, that's not what I want. That's not what I want at all. Verse 5, therefore I have hewn them by the prophets. I have slain them by the words of my mouth. And my judgment goes forth as a light, or even lightning. 6, for I desire steadfast love and not sacrifice, the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. Steadfast love is a technical term in a sense that needs some explication. It is variously translated. The word is chesed in Hebrew. It is sometimes translated mercy, loving kindness, steadfast love, loyal love, constancy, or loyalty. I don't know what version you have. Steadfast love, or chesed, was always a term of relationship. It was how you related to another person. It was also situational, which means things could be reversed. And it always had to do with a social superior giving aid or showing kindness or love to the inferior. For instance, when David and Jonathan made their pact, their covenant with one another, Jonathan at the time had more superiority. He was the son of a king. David was threatening Saul. Jonathan showed chesed to David by saving his life from Saul. A few years later, when the situation was reversed and David was king, then the superior, and Jonathan, Saul's family, was in disrepute, David kept his covenant with Jonathan and showed chesed not only to Jonathan, but even after Jonathan's death, continued to show chesed to Jonathan's descendants. It's situational. It can be reversed. One day you're hurting and your friend shows chesed to you. Next day the situation's reversed and your friend then does the same for you. And it's always from a superior to an inferior. It's not something among peers, you know. Here at Holden, we're a lot of peers, you know. We're all pretty much the same economic status. Everybody's on vacation. Well, not everybody, but transition or vacation. You know, we're pretty much peers, and so it's really easy to be nice to each other, you know. I'll let you in the shower first, and you go get a glass of milk for me at lunch or something, you know. Chesed is something always from a superior to an inferior. But this is not what high-born folks do as a part of their duty for the poor, writing out tax-deductible checks, because this is what high-born people do, you know. You get pictures of Victorian ladies sallying forth with their baskets of food and whatnot all to poor families, and meanwhile lecturing them on the sinfulness of their poverty. That's not chesed. Chesed is not a social obligation or a duty. It is an act of grace, and it's spontaneous. Even if you are in a position of power and the inferior person in a particular situation has no other recourse for help, you don't have to help them. If you do, it's because you choose to, not because you have to. It's freely given. It's grace. That's what God wants. Now, somebody in that first session talked about, well, that's what I'm supposed to give to God, because he contrasts that with sacrifice to God. Well, I think the way that we worship God is by those of us who are in positions of power, when we are in positions of power, show chesed to those who don't have it and who need it, and we can give it. Okay? That's how we worship God. Not by running around going to church on Sundays, or it looks as though Hosea is putting down all religious cult. He contrasts sacrifice and burnt offerings. They had different kinds of sacrifices. He's contrasting the religious cult, and cult's not necessarily negative here, because at this point it was so intermingled with Yahwism and the fertility thing that it was hard to tell them apart. You couldn't. But the important thing in your worship for God is caring for other folks, because he, God, the superior, has shown us chesed, we inferiors, and therefore we are unable to show it to others. If you're going to choose, that's what he wants over the sacrifice. The other is not inherently bad, however. Knowledge of God is the other pairing here with steadfast love, but it's another technical term. As we pointed out how it was, you know, in chapter 4, that was the problem. This is another layer, in a sense. Knowledge of God is not the head knowledge. That's why I hesitated talking about learning. It's not necessarily what you learn in confirmation class or even here. You get a lot of head knowledge here. I thought last night at the Kierkegaard presentation how we just dump you with all kinds of facts that I've read in all kinds of commentaries, and then you run off and I don't make you deal with them, or you don't want to, or you won't do it even if I tried to, or whatever. We all want to do that. We want to know about God, get it all stored up here, so when we have to talk to a fundy or somebody, we can just and knock them down, you know. But that's not what he's talking about here. For the Hebrews, they had much more, we're so Western and so Greek that we separate body and soul and head and emotions and all kinds of stuff. The Hebrews were a much more holistic people. To know was a very intimate term. It's the word for sexual intimacy. Adam knew his wife. And it's not just making love. It's not just that. It's the whole relationship, really knowing another person. It's to care for that person. I was thinking the other day, I think in church this occurred to me, that even though our children are yet preschoolers, their personalities make me think that we'll probably have a lot of battles when they're teenagers. And that if there's a battle on how I want them to behave, and I win, at least on the surface, they may do what I want, but with their little independent minds will let me know very clearly that they're only doing it as a part of their duty, or because I want it, or to avoid the consequences, or whatever. You know, but it's not because they care about that's what I really want. It's just that, oh, all right, if you want me to do it, I'll do it. You know, that's not knowledge of God. You know, you can care for people that way. But what God wants is to love me. To know me is to love me. Really care for me as I care for you. I'm running after you in the streets, you harlot. Why don't you care about me? I love you. And that's what this knowledge of God is here. And I think that that's why the whole idea of repentance as turning around is real crucial. The people quoted here in verse 1, come, let us return to the Lord, but it's just empty words for them. The prophets would talk about returning to the Lord as confession. You know, you're trotting down this road and you decide, oh, maybe we'll go back home. So you turn around. Usually you are dragged by the collar back home. None of us do it very willingly. The New Testament talks about metanoia. That's a turning around. confession is always an about face. You know, it's not that I've got to do the dishes today and write a sermon and take care of the kids and wash the diapers. And oh, by the way, there are those poor starving folks somewhere in the world and I got to write my congressman about bill number what's and what's. You know, it's something that I put on my list and when I'm done, I can cross it off and say, taking care of the poor today. Confession and a turning around is that you reorient your whole life. So caring for the poor is a part of the whole thing. And I may not write a letter today. But it is still a total refocusing to God to see the poor maybe in my midst sometimes. Sometimes it's your child right in front of you. Sometimes it's you right in front of you you don't want to care for because you're too busy about doing all the things on your list so you stack them up and say, God, see all these things I have done? You know, you don't worry about crossing things off your list when you have confessed and your whole life has turned around and you are loving God. Those things then are our outpourings of that love. And like I say, none of us ever get there permanently. It's always intermittent. It's always a returning around every day, as Luther says, 921. Let's see. As long as we got a few more minutes, we'll go into 7. Some more of the sins they do. Gilead is a city of evildoers, tracked with blood. They aren't sure what happened there, but sometimes the fertility cult required human sacrifice and even children sacrifice. And they suspect that that's what's going on there. Robbers lie in wait for the man, so the priests are banded together and they murder on the way to Shechem. That, again, is referring to an incident that happened. All of this is harlotry, says Hosea. In verse 4, verse 5, you get 5 through 7, no, even farther, you get a little picture of the kind of political machinations that are going on. The kings became sick with the heat of wine, they became drunk, stretched out his hand with mockers. Like an oven, their hearts burned with intrigue, going back and forth, first to sending folks to Assyria and then back to Egypt, and always trying to find out the short-term secure answer. All night their anger smolders. In the morning it blazes like a flaming fire. All of them are as hot as an oven, and they devour their rulers. In Israel, they had, I think 4 or 5 kings within a 10-year period or something. It was incredible. They were just murdering each other one after another. Let's see, where did I see that? Well, I can't remember. But anyway, that's a reference to the murdering, the kings. Somebody's always killing the next guy on the throne. Their kings have fallen, but none of them bothered to call on me. Ephraim mixes himself with the peoples. Ephraim is a cake not turned. What that cake not turned is it refers to little griddle cakes that they would make, and they were thin and they'd cook quickly, and so you'd have to turn them quickly or they would burn. Ephraim doesn't get turned. Got burn buns on one side and mush for brains on the other. Just ain't got it together in terms of their relationship with God. And so then they're all their relationships. Their relationships with the community they lived in are askew, and their political relationships are askew. And, of course, the way that their religious life. All of it is all askew.
Excuse me, is Ephraim a town or a land?
No, Ephraim is Israel. After the kingdom was divided, there was Israel and Judah. Ephraim was one of the tribes, and I don't know why that tribe was picked out. Does anybody know? Why is it called Ephraim and not Reuben or whatever? Anybody know? I don't know, but Hosea most often refers to Ephraim as Israel, the northern kingdom where he was prophesying to. And they were the ones who were going to be carted off by Assyria in 722, just decades before he wrote. Aliens devour his strength, and he doesn't even know it. All this running back and forth trying to make political alliances is ruining him, and he doesn't know it. 11, Ephraim is like a dove, silly and without sense, calling to Egypt, going to Assyria. And then verse 12, a picture of God as fowler. As they go, I will spread over them my net. I will bring them down like birds of the air. I will chastise them for their wicked deeds. Yeah.
They disappeared.
Yeah. One of Assyria's policies was to, the way they would stop rebellion from reoccurring is take off peoples from one place and put them in another country and take those from another here and dump them here. And so you didn't have the old relationships and the old kinships with which to effectively carry off a rebellion.
And that's what South Africa's doing right now.
Yeah.
They
learned a whole lot. Yeah. Yeah. That is a real effective, you know, divide and conquer. Sometimes some peoples conquer and leave the conquered peoples there and bring in, I think the Romans did that, didn't they, mainly? They just bring in a standing armies. You don't have quite the military bill if you just ship these people off. And that's what happened. And then they became the 10 lost tribes, or it's called the diaspora. Well, maybe. Diaspora might be from 586, though, huh, with Babylon? Well, anyway, they were dispersed, regardless of what the term is. Yeah, then they're lost. Well, in a sense, they're lost. I think that's probably the bulk of it. What I would like you to do right now, let's see, okay, is that, do you remember yesterday, most of you were here yesterday, when we talked about the real root to the problem with the fertility cult is the whole issue of security. You know, going after the security issues. Will I survive, rather than trusting God with your whole life? And we talked about the different idols that we all have. Now, I'd like to take a couple minutes, two or three, to think of three of your idols, your personal idols. Don't list this country's idols. It's too easy to blame on somebody else. Your own personal idols, the things that if you had to give up, you'd die in some sense. Yeah, I'm deathly afraid of, you know, being sick and not having insurance.
Essentially, that's security, isn't it?
You bet it is. I'm even afraid of not having our policies all in line, and they aren't right now. You know, if my husband dies, I have $80,000 short of what I want to have. You know.
Better take care of him.
We're waiting for the next Consumer Reports article to come out so we can do all this. You see. Insurance is a real big one for us.
Don't know what I'll do when the day comes I can't drive anymore. Mm-hmm. Half my life will be over, absolutely.
Yeah.
I think my ability is gone. Mm-hmm. I'm terrible enough to be able to communicate.
Mm-hmm. That's connected to mine. One of my fears is that I would not be able to preach or do Bible studies, and of course that fear is in high gear coming up here, you know. Yeah. Really panic that I don't do a good job here. That's real terrifying. You know, a lot of what I've been hearing are things that are connected to our identities and to our independence. Losing our identity. We did this in the staff Bible study this morning, and it was kind of interesting that we got to the point of, well, what can't you give up except God? Now, what if you had to give up your idols? I mean, none of us are going to do it willingly. We admit that. What if they are wrenched from you? We don't know how, you never know how you're going to react. But let's just take a test case. You lost your job, and for some reason, you were unemployable, and you ended up on the streets of Seattle or whatever with your family. What would you would survive.
Some people would turn to God.
Okay.
Even though they hadn't.
Okay. What else might happen?
You might not survive.
That's right. You might not survive. But while you still were hanging on to life.
You feel sorry for yourself.
Yeah, I sure would.
I don't know. Sometimes I think it would be better if I could see my husband. Well, there's nine jobs. We got this, we got that. It would just be nice to get rid of all those complications. It would be so much easier because our values would be where they're supposed to be, and there'd be some peace and serenity there. Now, he's in the middle of a possible transition with his partnership and a job, and I said, oh, don't worry about it. We'll make it. And I have no problem with him.
Boy, through that.
It's always
was easy to watch everybody else smash their idols.
But I think I feel loved at the first point. If I could just live in a tent. Well, you know, you don't have to worry about washing walls and windows or getting the cobwebs out or something like that.
Our possessions really can rob us of life.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if we can't draw on those resources that God's given us out on the streets. Now, I can do it. I've got a mind that really can be creative if I want to use it.
Okay, and what would you do with your creativity on the streets?
I'd probably go work in a gas station or something like that. And
Gloria says that she wants to unite the vegans. And she, her next, right now she's working for the Today Show, and she's one of their reporters. And it's interesting to see what she's really going to talk to. She would unite the vegans.
Unionize them too?
I don't know about unionizing, but getting them to get their self-worth together. That's one thing I'm afraid of when people lose everything. Their self-worth is in that everything and not in themselves. I know if I was devastated, I'd go right to that campus because of Lutheran Center down in Pioneer Square and get busy helping. I think that if you have the know-it-all right now, that if you lost everything, that brain of yours can keep on moving and you can start getting things shaken.
And what does that brain then start doing once again of yours and your creativity? What do we create again? Aha, that's right. We'd all get down there and we'd just organize a little band down the streets and we'd be top dog or do whatever. So what's that tell you? That's right. That's right.
I think the thing that I would fear most losing would be my perception of who God is. The way that I think about God. Because what would happen then, if those were gone, I could go on breathing, but I don't know whether I'd have the energy or I'd have the desire to go on living because everything would be so uprooted for me. The meaning behind doing the things that I do would be gone.
Are you saying that your circumstances to a degree influence your perceptions of God?
I think that so, but more than that, I have structures about the way that I think about God. I mean, that's part of what's why when women start talking about this way with God or this way with God, I probably feel the hairs in the back of my head start to bristle because I'm not quite ready to jar my things around a little bit. I prefer my own perception. I mean, I struggled for them. It took a long time for them to fall into place or whatever. And should they be removed, I don't know where I'd start again. I really don't know where I would start again. I'd really be lost.
Picture the Cambodians, Malaysians, and Vietnam people that have been shipped from their country, don't even know our language, don't know anything, surviving. Some of the kids are playing the piano as well as Mariko did last night. You have to. I don't think we could be shipped to another country and survive like that. I really think Americans couldn't survive. Because we haven't had to survive in so long.
You might be surprised.
I think that we can.
Well, I hope we can. I hope we can.
I think that there are survival skills. I think that God becomes more present. When that's taken away from me. I became energized when I lost my job. And it was an energy that I had not felt for years. It was an energy that I know was faith that God gave me. Push, shove. I think we could survive.
With two teenage kids, I think you're constantly changing.
Like yesterday last night, after the Iowa farmers, after the farmers still
I hope my perception of God will be refined and changed. I don't want them in cement. I think I'd have more trouble with physical, loss of physical health. I can see myself picking myself up. If I've got my health and say my family's stability, I could suffer the material losses, but boy, some of us really have a tough time lying in bed not being able to move or communicate or take it.
Mm-hmm.
It's strange though in my case, the times when more has been taken from me are the times when I was more aware of my relationship with God. And somehow the rest of it didn't matter all that much. But what really frightened me was what would I have been without that relationship?
Darius.
I think,
too,
I think the biggest idol may be God. Somebody said I can't live without God, but I think that our perception of who what God is probably our biggest idol. And once we create God in our own image all the time rather than the other way around. Mm-hmm. Master Eckhart has a short little prayer, God, you be your God. It's a very tough prayer to pray because it means that I have to rid myself of my perception of God in order to receive God anew. And that is difficult.
The one thing I can feel that being brought down and having all the idols stripped, that we really learn compassion for other people. I mean, and we were talking about building those idols back up and taking that creative energy. Yes, maybe that happens, but I often think, thank God for these neat experiences of being brought down, because I'm able, in some cases, to really empathize and really be inside people and reach out and not be afraid because I've had those experiences. So I wonder if that creative energy isn't positive, if it is just a basic feeling.
I think we have to learn to be confused, how about the person to do it. And sometimes we need to do things when it's independent, but it's very difficult to do it with the human.
Which is a real faith problem for us. As Lutherans, we believe that we only receive the faith. Any of you afraid of losing your trust in God?
That's why I came to hold it. If all these very intelligent, wonderful, important people believe, then it really confirms my belief.
Can that be an idol?
I don't know.
I think that this is very much in the life of Jesus too. Because I don't feel that anybody's faith in one of those is devoid of that doubtfulness of that deep, you know. Do I trust God, or where is He in my life, or I don't see the direction I'm supposed to be going on. I don't feel you've gotten where you are without probably a lot more of that than we have.
A lot more faith?
A lot more struggling because of your commitment to your...
Are you talking about me personally?
Yeah.
You need to hear my story. Why do you say I'm committed? How do you know that? Because I put on a good show? Because I'm so intent on doing a good job here? Why does that mean
I have your husband. That's why I know.
Don't sell yourself short, or any of you.
No,
I mean,
no, but I'm saying, when we said people who have been called to be pastors, theologians, this sort of thing, set them apart from the faith struggle that the laity experience, it's not any different. You know what I'm saying? We all have the same faith struggle.
Oh, yes, okay.
Probably yours more so than maybe mine. Yeah. I don't know. But
yeah, well, I guess I'd be afraid to say that, you know. I mean, ordination or anything like that doesn't mean that you have gone through any more struggles or, you know. I do good public speaking. So did my mother. I come by it natural. It's a gift. It happens to fit this profession. Also like theology, but that too was a gift. Maybe I haven't struggled.
What we have that we don't always acknowledge.
Hi.
We don't always acknowledge is an enormous amount of cultural capital. And we have it to greater or lesser extent. And when we say, well, we could have all of our things stripped away, we have so much cultural capital that we know that to build those things back up again, we have the resources to be able to do that. And then if we go to another country or another culture, that a lot of that cultural capital is simply translatable into another culture. And it takes a little bit of effort. But it's almost universally translatable. A certain amount of it is translatable into other cultures, you know. It's part of being a human being. And some of that is bound up with our self-esteem. I think that if we have that stripped away from us, and along with that goes our self-esteem, then we're at our roots. Then we've, maybe that's part.
part of our gods and goddesses inside is that the cultural capital that we carry around with us that we often deny that we even have, mm-hmm. but it's there, and it's a desperately important part of who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What if something happens with our minds, our faith, our bodies, our
lives? You mean if we're assuming that the idols are a product of our minds working, can we then have idols? Well, I don't know. That's beyond me.
But you don't know it. If your mind's not there, you don't know it. The people that suffer are your family. The people that suffer. Because I'm working in the person, none of us want to do that, because you don't know it. So
that's one way we protect ourselves, is by tripping out, not being aware, and refusing to accept reality. Perhaps that's what would happen if we were stripped of our idols.
We would lose it all. Yeah. Any more?
Well, I think in sometimes that I know the struggle I see in my family. I have five children, and we have a tendency, I think, to not to take away from your perspective, because I think it's one story.
Oh, I like it too, but I don't think it's better than any other.
I think we are always putting, or I feel this in our culture, that education and all those things, that's the only way to go. And I now work, but I didn't work at all when we were little, and I just see so much women being insignificant being a mother. And let me tell you, raising five children, I feel very proud of doing it, but I wish I could give that gift to other people to realize that this is really something wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It is a struggle, and you have to search for God a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Just sometimes wish I could get out of the corner and say,
hey,
you are worth
something. Ruth and I share that pastor, and with the three kids, she goes in on Tuesday and Thursday to church, and I go in on Monday and Wednesday. I work on Tuesday and Thursday. That's when I really have to work. When she is late coming in, I'm wondering where. Are you, Ruby? And get here soon.
Out there saving souls. You did good work on this. I think that's the real real crux of Hosea, to see that we are those people there, and that they weren't such an aberration, but that we got all those idols too. We don't want to give them up. And maybe cannot give them up. We aren't different than those folks. We've got some more time yet. This feels like a natural end, but we have 12 minutes. Do you want to go with anything else or look at another?
Can you explain what you have up at the store that we can, you said you had a copy of
it? They sold it out. I should have told them, well, I didn't know. I'm always doing, I should have.
He showed
you $5. Do you all know this man? This is a bishop in a different church.
And
he's also a board member on Holden Village. This is a little four-part thing that, I'll plug campus ministry. I was in campus ministry in Las Vegas, and they have some nice little publications. They're doing a series right now of peer-led Bible studies, and the point is that a student in college could take this stuff, this is the leader's guide, and then his or her peers would have this little thing folded over two parts, and they could then do a Bible study without the campus pastor or campus minister being right there. And so I wrote this, about a year ago, I guess, a four-part thing on Hosea, and I have a little glossary in there, which I just love, because I forget who Jezreel and all this stuff is from month to month. I mean, it's, you know, Dan Rather never talks about it, so I'm not, never reminded of it, you know. These are real cheap. What the bookstore selling for? $75, and they're probably even cheaper from campus ministry. Holden needs a little markup, of course, because of, well, I mean, you know, they have to operate this place. Here's the address right here if you want to get it later. And they would probably send you, I know they've got a lot of these backlogged, I've been told. And they have a lot of other ones that have been done, 4 to 6 part things that you might find, you know, real useful in your parish or something too. So they'd probably send you a whole list of what they got. But they're just little short things. Oh gosh, I could do that. That's right. Darius is a campus minister. I met Elmer at a campus ministry orientation thing. Not a campus. NLCM will do. National Lutheran Campus Ministry. 35. Is this big enough?
Yeah.
Whacker.
So often I write them, I don't.
They're in a suite. Tells how uptown they are, huh? Just ask for Laurel. I called the other day and I hadn't seen her in years. She says, Ruth, how are you with those kids? She had heard. I had like the effort. Oh, maybe so. But he got the choice blessing. Maybe so. That could be it. Yeah. Tomorrow it's Hosea 11. When Israel was a child, I loved him.